Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, the 1978 publication of The World According to Garvey, huge bestseller, put writer John Irving on the literary map. Now, out with his 12th novel, he is one of America's fiction greats. His latest novel, Last Night in Twisted River, has sex, bears, love, death, big woods, and a father and son on the run. This hour, On Point, John Irving on life and his new novel, Last Night in Twisted River. You can join the conversation. Are you a John Irving junkie? What brings you back? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. John Irving was born in New Hampshire, raised by his mother and stepfather. He went to Phillips Exeter Academy, famously wrestled. He's in the National Wrestling Hall of Fame in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Studied writing at the Iowa Writers Workshop, worked there with Kurt Vonnegut. He's the best-selling author, The World According to Garp, A Prayer for Owen Meany, Until I Find You, and many more. He's won the National Book Award, an O. Henry Award, and an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for The Cider House Rules. His new novel is Last Night in Twisted River. Critics are all over on it. The Financial Times calls it a big-hearted, brilliantly written, superbly realized intergenerational tale of father and son on the lam, absolutely unmissable. The Washington Post says, disappointing wipeout. John Irving joins us now from New York. It's a tough world out there. Mr. Irving, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
So does it make you want to get these guys in a headlock when they don't like your books? Or are you past all that with your 12th one out there now?
Well, by the time you've written more than three or four novels, it's often true that the exercise of being reviewed is one of being condescended to by your inferiors. So I expect it.
At the same time, you've got people who absolutely love this, and it is quite a tale. I love the story of how the idea kind of popped into your head. Was it really Dylan in the car, or the pickup truck, whatever, on the way to the doctor's office, and there it was?
Well, no, that's been somewhat exaggerated. This novel has been in the back of my mind longer than any of the 12 novels. For 20 years, really, I've had the idea of a story about a cook and his pre-teenage son who become fugitives who go on the run and are running for 50 years. The fragment from that Dylan song, which I'd heard many times, from Tangled Up in Blue, I'd always seen it or imagined it as an epigraph to this novel, if I ever found a way to begin it. The simultaneity of the song itself and my driving north in Vermont to a doctor's appointment was simply that it was actually listening to that song, as I had many times before, when I thought of the last sentence to this novel. And I never really begin the process of actually writing a novel until I get the last sentence, which for some reason is something I see first.
The last sentence on the far side of a lot of work in between, as you say, a lot of decades here, father and son on the run, starts in the New Hampshire, big woods, logging country. It's got a kind of the bear imagery, so famous from your work, comes to bear early on. You've got Dominique and his son who becomes the writer, his son Daniel. I wonder if you'd read a scene for us, a pretty critical scene here from fairly early in the book. We've learned a lot about the logging life by the time we get to this. He's a cook in a logging camp, father and son. And one night the son hears something going on and what goes to the scene with a heavy skillet, frying pan, and goes to work.
Yes, the cook has mistakenly told the boy a famous tall tale about a night when a bear breaks into the cookhouse and the cook single-handedly grabs a cast-iron skillet and swats the bear in the face with the skillet, and the bear runs out of the cookhouse. And it's an impressionable tale to tell a young boy, and for that reason, Danny has bears or the threat of bears much on his mind.
Could you read for us this scene? It's nighttime. He goes into his father's bedroom and, oh.
What Danny Bacigalupo would see, more accurately what he thought he saw upon entering his dad's bedroom, was everything the 12-year-old had feared and worse, that is, both bigger and hairier than what the boy had ever imagined a bear could be. Only his father's knees and feet were visible beneath the bear. More frightening still, his dad's lower legs weren't moving. Maybe the boy had arrived too late to save him. Only the bear was moving. The rounded, humpback beast, its head not discernible, was rocking the entire bed, its glossy black hair both longer and more luxuriant than Danny had ever imagined a black bear's hair would be. The bear was consuming his father, or so it appeared to the 12-year-old. With no weapon at hand, one might have expected the boy to throw himself on the animal attacking his dad in such a savage or frenzied manner, if only to be hurled into a bedroom wall or raked to death by the beast's claws. But family histories, chiefly perhaps the stories we are told as children, invade our most basic instincts and inform our deepest memories, especially in an emergency. Young Dan reached for the 8-inch cast-iron skillet as if it were his weapon of choice, not his father's. That skillet was a legend, and Danny knew exactly where it was. Holding the handle in both hands, the boy stepped up to the bed and took aim at where he thought the bear's head ought to be. He'd already started his two-handed swing, as Ketchum had once shown him with an axe, being sure to get his hips behind the swinging motion, when he noticed the bare soles of two clearly human feet. The feet were in a prayerful position, just beside his dad's bare knees, and Danny thought that the feet looked a lot like Jane's. The Indian dishwasher was on her feet all day, and for such a heavy woman, it was only natural that her feet often hurt her. She liked nothing better, she'd told young Dan, than a foot rub, which Danny had more than once given her. Jane? Danny asked, in a small, doubting voice, but nothing slowed the forward momentum of the cast-iron skillet. Jane must have heard the boy utter her name because she raised her head and turned to face him. That was why the skillet caught her full force on the right temple. The ringing sound, a dull but deep gong, was followed by a stinging sensation young Dan first felt in his hands. A reverberant tingle passed through both wrists and up his forearms. For the rest of his life, or as long as his memory endured, it would be small consolation to Danny Bacigalupo that he didn't see the expression on Jane's pretty face when the skillet struck her. Her hair was so long that it simply covered everything. Jane's massive body shuddered. She was too massive, and her hair was too sleekly beautiful for her ever to have been a black bear, not in this life or the next, where she most assuredly was going. Jane rolled off the cook and crashed to the floor. There was no mistaking her for a bear now. Her hair had fanned out, flung wide as wings to both sides of her inert, colossal torso. Her big, beautiful breasts had slumped into the hollows of her armpits. Her motionless arms reached over her head, as if, even in death, Jane sought to hold aloft a heavy, descending universe. But as astonishing as her nakedness must have been to an innocent 12-year-old, Danny Bacigalupo would best remember the faraway gaze in Jane's wide-open eyes. Something more than the final split-second recognition of her fate lingered in Jane's dead eyes. What had she suddenly seen in the immeasurable distance, Danny would wonder? Whatever Jane had glimpsed of the unforeseeable future had clearly terrified her. Not just her fate, but all their fates, maybe.
John Irving, reading from his new novel, Last Night in Twisted River. I love that passage. Thank you very much for reading it. It's It's beautiful and kind of wild and very John Irving somehow. And I was thinking again as you read it how you really seem to love your characters. How does that happen?
Well, it happens very slowly. There's always a kind of roadmap of a novel before I begin. I know what the action of the story is, who the characters are, when, how they meet, if their paths cross again, most important, if they live or die, and if they die, how and where. Those kind of skeletal landmarks are in place before I start the actual writing of the novel. So the sheer pleasure for me is the filling in of all the detail, because the scaffolding of the story, of the building I'm going to build, is very rudimentary. It's very bare. And what I love about writing most of all is the physical and visual detail. It was those novels of the 19th century, Dickens and Hardy, but also my fellow New Englanders, Hawthorne and Melville, who first made me want to be a writer. Those plotted 19th century novels, usually with developed characters over a considerable passage of time.
John Irving, can you stand by for just a moment? We've got to take a short break right here. I can't wait to come back. John Irving's new novel is Last Night in Twisted River. A little inspiration there from Bob Dylan right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with John Irving.
Boat right outside of Delacroix, but all the while I was alone, the past was close behind. I've seen a lot of women, but she never escaped my mind. I just
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist John Irving about life and his latest novel, Last Night in Twisted River. John Irving joins us today from New York. I've seen you quoted quoting Melville, John, saying, "Woe to him who seeks to please rather than appall." What do you take from that? You've always got these great, some call them grotesque or just appalling or certainly sort of wild, climactic moments in your books, and yeah, they appall in a kind of in a way that makes this frisson that people really respond to. Do you aim for that? Why do you aim for that? What does it do for your work?
Well, I think what I best loved about those 19th century novels I've read as a teenager was how dramatically written they were. Extreme things happened. You were extremely fond of characters to whom, in many cases, the worst possible things happened. And there is a certain willful perversity and obsession, really, in many of my novels, that terrible things happen to people you love, or that what everyone fears is losing loved ones. The obsessiveness is not a part of the plan. I plan the plots of my novels very slowly, very, very carefully. I know what the fates of my characters are before I begin writing. But these novels are, this one in particular, they're more about what I fear, about what I hope never happens to me or people I love, than they are remotely about what has actually happened to me. And I've always believed that you can't expect an audience to be anxious for what's going to happen to your characters if two things don't happen first. First, the reader has to love these characters, and then the reader has to feel considerable apprehension for what might befall them. And it's my job to first create these characters and then, frankly, make the worst things I can imagine for them come true.
You've You've often pulled a lot of autobiography into your books, as you say, even from kind of a negative space here, even if it's not what happened, but the fears of the writer, of yourself, John Irving. You've got a father-son relationship at the heart of Twisted River here. Yet your father-son facts of life have always been complicated. Tell us about the book first. I mean, Dominique and Daniel's, tell us something about their relationship as father and son on the run. After that, the slaying of Injun Jane that we heard there with the heavy skillet, her backwoods boyfriend, the lawman Carl, is sort of maniacally on their tail, a kind of Javert over decades pursuit like in Les Mis. What are you laying out in terms of a father-son relationship within that unusual dynamic?
Well, I've written about that before. In the Cider House Rules, the orphanage physician is not the actual father of the principal orphan who is never adopted, at least never successfully adopted. And they develop a relationship that is certainly as close and as conflicted as many father-son relationships are. I still have a very close relationship with my stepfather. My mom was remarried to him when I was six. But before that time, I carried the name of my biological father, whom I didn't know, and it was understood in my family that we just didn't talk about him, about who he was. It was many years later. I was already in my late 50s, early 60s, when I discovered that I had a couple of brothers I didn't know I had, half-brothers, and a half-sister I didn't know I had. And I learned about my biological father for the first time. It doubtless has been a great source of my imagination, since no one would tell me anything about this guy. I think successfully been imagining him or reimagining him, inventing him and reinventing him over the course of many novels. It's not, I think, purely circumstantial that so many of these stories are about families with secrets, families who are missing members, children who grow up not knowing something or having been misled about something in their past or in the past of one or more of their parents.
I read along the way somewhere you threatened your mother she wouldn't tell you about your biological father. You'd have to make it up in fiction. Of course, in Garp, you've got the woman straddling the unconscious soldier and, you know, becoming pregnant, leading to the birth of Garp. You kind of followed through on that threat, I'd say.
Well, the threat is a little strong. I used to tease my mother about this. It wasn't... It truly wasn't very personal.
A good-natured threat, maybe. But you've made a lot of it. I've got questions for you, John Irving, if I may. Here from Facebook, Kimberly says, your characters are also vivid. Do you ever imagine how characters from different novels might interact? I'd love to hear a conversation between Jenny Fields, Garp, daughter Alice, until I find you, for example, and between Owen Meany and anyone. Do they live in your mind in that way or not?
Well, I don't think of characters from different stories ever meeting each other or interacting, but certainly there are characters in new novels who have clearly evolved from characters in past novels. The character of Owen Meany is clearly derived from the character of the orphan with the fatal respiratory infection, Fuzzy Stone, in the Cider House Rules. They're basically the same character. They both die prematurely, although for hugely different reasons. The character of the skydiver in this novel, in Last Night in Twisted River, Lady Sky, she's called, is very much the same as the character of Emma in Until I Find You, and Emma's the same as the character of Hester in A Prayer for Owen Meany, and she's the same as the character of Melanie in The Cider House Rules. In every case, this big, sexually aggressive, frankly outspoken character who seems, when we first meet her, to be a kind of menace, a threat mm-hmm. to the younger, less sure of himself male character, but who in truth turns out to be a kind of rescue figure, a kind of virtual protector.
We've got callers coming in for you, John Irving. Carol in Essex, New York. You're on the air with John Irving.
Hello. My favorite book of yours is A Prayer for Owen Meany, and I was interested because there were so many levels that you could read in that book, one of them being the spiritual or the religious symbolism, and I wondered if there was any kind of level like that in the newest book.
The spiritual. John?
No, I wouldn't say so. I wouldn't say in the story of last night in Twisted River that there is a kind of prophet figure or a figure who seems to be preternaturally informed of his own destiny to the degree that Owen Meany is. In the case of that character and that novel, in A Prayer for Owen Meany, I was simply trying to imagine what nature of miracle I would need to be witness to in order to make a believer of me. Mm-hmm. And so in the character of the narrator, the best friend, the sidekick, Johnny Wheelwright, I tried to create the experience of someone who becomes a disciple. He sees something in Owen Meany, his best friend, that he cannot explain other than by spiritual terms. It makes a believer of him.
It seems in the new book it may not be a spiritual matter, but your moral center is this very rough-hewn logging character named Ketchum, a best friend to the father, Dominique. It shows up throughout the book, really kind of tough as leather, backwoods guy. I enjoyed, maybe most of all in this book, those scenes, the backwoods scenes, the kind of real elemental here. It's kind of the kind of environment that I think a lot of people are just cut off from these days. I sensed you enjoying it well as you pulled up all these details out of so the 1950s logging camp life, the this very rough-hewn there. Do you miss that? Do you long for that? You're seen as kind of a disciplined, I don't know, in some part rough-hewn guy despite your prep school and all the rest. Is it something about rubbing that up against modern life that that makes sparks for you?
Well, I think there are a lot of neglected and angry people in our country, mostly in rural America, who feel that everything about progress, everything about the contemporary world has moved on and left them out. I purposely made Ketchum a river driver, and I set the novel in that period of time in northern New England when the river drives themselves were coming to a close. Mm-hmm. Ketchum's very way of life is about to be taken from him.
That is, the river's full of logs coming down from the cutting.
Yeah, and it wasn't long before the beginning of this book. It wasn't long after that, in the late 50s and 60s, when they stopped driving logs down rivers in New Hampshire and Vermont, and the last log drive in Maine was down the Kennebec in 76. So a way of life went out, and in the points of view of those guys who used to drive logs over water, it was replaced by a half-assed system that wasn't half as good or as efficient and easily three or four times as expensive.
That is, diesel trucks deep in the woods.
Yeah, but this is representative in Ketchum's case of where his radical libertarianism comes from. Ketchum distrusts and despises authority from government on down, all governments, all authorities. And I needed to give him a concrete background in a real world that had been changed against his will in order, I thought, to make his political anger verifiable.
It's a certifiably verifiable, and I recognize it as one that echoes in this country right now. Nashville, Tennessee, Charles, you're on the air with John Irving.
Yes, love your work. And
thank you.
As the previous caller said, Owen Meany, love that. Cider House Rules, just super. I also love the work of one of your contemporaries, Tom Wolfe. And I have read where Wolfe wrote about the criticism of his work by you and John Updike and one or two others. And it's interesting to me how two really great writers like yourself and Wolfe could have the same muse, and that is Dickens. Can you comment on that?
Great. Charles, thanks. John Irving, how about it?
Well, it's hard to see in the way he uses language, Mr. Wolfe, what it is about Dickens that he loved. The social aspects, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
The writing about the society, I guess. You have to understand that the animosity toward Wolfe that was expressed by myself, by John Updike, by Norman Mailer, and I know is felt by many other writers, doesn't emanate solely from why we think he is a not very good writer. It emanates from a kind of position paper that Wolfe wrote shortly after the Bonfire of the Vanities book was published, in which he laid out a kind of white paper, a kind of manifesto, a kind of directive about what the rest of us novelists should be doing, what we should be writing about. And that kind of puerile prescription irritated a lot of people. I know in Updike's case, for example, he never would have trashed Wolfe the way he did in The New Yorker if he hadn't been so irked about Wolfe telling the rest of us not only how we should be writing, but actually what we should be writing about.
What did you find puerile about it?
Well, I think it's childish to tell other writers that they should do it the way you do it.
Mm-hmm.
I've been very open about my method or my process as a writer, but the last thing I would do is recommend it to someone else. Simply because I begin every novel with the last sentence first, I don't go around saying to people, if you only begin your novels with the last sentence first, you might actually get better at this.
But it was also he was also calling for a focus on the nitty-gritty of life, wasn't he not, instead of sort of a minimalist, abstract the novels that had become so popular?
I didn't see it that way.
Oh, I mean, I would have thought that in some ways you and Wolfe share some of that. These are not postmodernist novels that you're writing.
I really can't comment on what he and I share.
We hear it, or we hear the absence of it. You've got a note tacked on your wall from Rilke. Works of art are of an infinite loneliness. Is that of the act of imagining, the act of writing? Where's the loneliness?
Well, it's a very solitary job. I spend anywhere from 3 to 7 years writing a book. I don't share what I'm doing with very many people in the process of writing that book. You have to like being alone if you're going to be a novelist. You better like it, because you're going to be alone much of the time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist John Irving about life and his latest novel, his 12th Last Night in Twisted River. Let's go to Helen calling from Woburn, Massachusetts. Helen, you're on the air with John Irving.
Hello. Keep passing the open windows. It's
Thank
great
you.
To get to talk to you. In Prayer for Owen Meany, you wrote so wonderfully and so heartbreakingly about the Vietnam conflict and about America's short memory and, you know, amnesia. And I wondered if in light of that, you would comment on the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts. Thank you.
Thank you, Helen. John Irving?
I don't think it's an entirely comparable situation to Vietnam, but I also think one has to be careful about premature predictions. I remember feeling, as a kid of the Vietnam generation, I remember feeling very strongly that in the late years of the Vietnam War, I sincerely believed that I would never see my country as divided again as it was at that time. But I think the division in the country now is greater and more severe, and it's a rift that is occurring for more than one reason, not only for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, whereas in the case of the Vietnam War, the rift really was, for the most part, focused on that ill-conceived, ill-managed conflict. In this case now, there seems to also be a huge cultural divide, a huge liberal-conservative divide, a right and left wing divide of a kind that I'm more familiar from in certain European countries, and which is more extreme and severe than I remember it being at the time of Vietnam. But the issues that are so divisive now are more numerous, more various. There are just many more of them than the issues involving Afghanistan and Iran alone. I think we're at a kind of cultural, almost an education watershed. There's a lot of fear-mongering going on. I'm amazed to see how the socialism word is being fearfully raised by the conservatives in this country in much the manner that communism was by the McCarthyites. And yet, you know, I travel a lot. I live part of my life in Canada. My wife's Canadian. Mm-hmm. There are so many successful democracies around the world that are far more socialized than we are and ever will be. I think there's a lot more to fear in this country than socialism. What a strange thing to be afraid of. It seems to me that we've got more splitting us apart now, much more than what's happening in Afghanistan and Iraq.
I mean, that's really interesting because if you think back to those years, I mean, there was definitely the divide between the sort of, you know, long-haired protester and the crew-cut cop. I remember, you know, there were sort of stand-up-and-be-counted Americans, conservative calls to rally around a conservative culture in those days, and obviously there was this your sort of counterculture. I mean, the very word counterculture indicates that there was a gap then. I wonder why it would be bigger now, and what you see is the evidence that it's larger, deeper. There clearly was some gap in those days.
Yeah, there was a gap, all right. You're right, but the focus was a little easier to see. You know, you still have people blowing the bully patriotism whistle when all else fails, wave the flag and declare your love of country.
Mm.
It's been certainly a successful smokescreen. To most people who don't live in this country, the question I get asked when I go to places for translations and stuff most of the mm-hmm. time is why don't more Americans know more about the rest of the world? And maybe if they did, and especially in particular, if they knew a little more about the way the rest of the world sees us and why, they might not be so insular and so belligerent about the patriotism word.
And waving that flag. I mean, you live part of the time in Canada, partly because your wife is Canadian, but I've read comments from you that sounded as though there are moments when you're tempted to just keep going. North, out.
Well, I wouldn't do that. My children are here, my grandchildren are here, and as a writer, unlike the advice that Ketchum gives Danny in Last Night in Twisted River, I believe if you're going to do a good job of picking on your country's soft spots, you better live there. You better know what you're talking about.
Let's go to Charles in Ipswich, Massachusetts. Charles, you're on the air with John Irving.
Hi, John. I just flipped this on, and I love the topic. I did the Northern Forest Canoe Trail this summer to the 740-mile canoe trip starting in the Adirondacks and goes up to northern Maine, and you pretty much just canoe the roots of these old loggers, and I was hoping you could talk a little more about why the industry fell apart and kind of the history of it. You touched on a bit. I was hoping for a little more.
Yeah, it's compelling stuff and great material for the book. How about it, John? Did you do research to bring it all to life, or did you know it from life experience? You've got a lot of detail in there on the old logging way.
Well, my uncle was in the logging business in the northern part of New Hampshire. My cousins are still involved in that company, so my cousins were of great assistance to me in introducing me to a couple of old-timers who could take me in and show me some of the old camps. And but I remember those log drives. I remember seeing them in the 50s and 60s when I was a teenager. It's still an argument in certain parts of northern New England that those river drives are gone. You know, one of the reasons, though, this book that was in the back of my mind for so long was so quickly forthcoming once I began to write it, was that there is often an obstacle before me before I can begin the actual writing of a novel, which is the research, which is how much I have to learn about something that is at times utterly foreign to me, the medical detail in the Cider House Rules or in A Son of the Circus. For example, the church organ music in Northern Europe, in the Baltic and North Sea ports, which is such a huge part of Until I Find You. That was really difficult for me. I had to study those situations to get into the points of view of those characters for upwards to a year before I could write a word. In the case of this book, because I grew up in New Hampshire, because I spent so many summers in Maine, the logging research was you know, it's where I live. It was totally available to me. And the part of this novel which so much concerns cooking, because one of the main characters is a cook,
Dominique,
was also more available to me. I've been cooking since I was a teenager. I had various jobs in various restaurants, and I've got some good friends who are chefs in restaurants of the kind this novel describes. And then they invited me into those restaurant kitchens and made my work as a researcher very immediate. Very immediate. I think that's one of the reasons this book came together once I got started, came together much more quickly than some others have.
Very immediate, and judging from the work, pleasurable as well. Linda, in Arlington, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say, first of all, I'm a huge fan. You're number one on my list of favorite authors. We still say in my family, watch out for the undertow when things happen. I was interested to hear you say that you write the end first, because I, thinking about the end of Owen Meany, and I can still get chills remembering how just incredibly it came together. But anyway, I'm calling because I have a dyslexic daughter, and I read that you were dyslexic, and I find that so hard to believe, and I just wondered if you'd comment on that.
Mr. Irving.
Well, I had a long undiagnosed learning disability when I was in high school in the 50s and early 60s. They didn't call learning disabilities then. I just assumed that I was a bad student and I was slow. And I used to ask my classmates, you know, I'd say, how long did it take you to do the history? And if my friend said, oh, it's 45 minutes, I would double that time or triple that time. And I knew that meant an hour and a half or more work for me. It's never hurt me to go slow as a writer. But in the area of being a student, which is so much a part of multitasking, you know, you're carrying four major courses, maybe two minor courses. You're hopping in from short periods of concentration to another period of equally short but no less intense concentration. That's the kind of thing that people with any kind of learning disability find very difficult and very challenging. School was tough for me. But the farther I went in school, by the time I got to graduate school and one was specializing, the more I did one thing for more hours of a day, the more I realized that the learning disability, so-called, began to disappear. I didn't even know I had such a thing until my middle son was diagnosed with a dyslexia. And the learning disabilities teacher brought me into meet with her and my son after school one day and said, now, I want you to observe the way this boy reads. You see if he loses his place on the page, if he doesn't have his finger on the actual sentence he's reading, he can't find where he was unless he goes right back up to the top left-hand corner of that same page. And when she said that, I said, so what's the matter with that?
Right. And that's life.
And so, I mean, I thought, well, how else do you do it, right? And she looked at me sort of stricken with the utmost sympathy and said, Mr. Irving, would you read a page or two for me? And, you know, and I did. And there went my finger instinctively like an inchworm out to the very line I was reading. And I can't tell you, you know, it was an enormous relief to me. Because for all those years, I just felt stupid. And I thought, oh my God, there's actually something wrong with me. I was elated. I was so excited to find it out.
I think there's some encouragement there for our caller, for her daughter. Once you got to your focus, though, a lot of this fell away as an issue. Your single-minded focus.
My children know me well enough to know that I still mistranscribe numbers. If they're calling me from somewhere and they're giving me a phone number the phone, for example, they basically give me the number and then they say, Dad, you want to read that back?
They've got you.
Because they know, I'm going to write 321312. They know that. They know that.
I've got a question here from the website. This is Steve, and he's saying for you, he's wondering whether John Irving thinks fiction writers today bear any responsibility for the generally lackluster sales of literary fiction. Are readers, he writes, getting dumber, or are too many fiction writers failing to speak to them in a meaningful way?
Well, I don't know where the statistics come from. I have to say this, that The World According to Garp, my fourth novel, was my first bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
And it is misremembered in this way. It is thought to have been a much bigger bestseller than it ever truly was as a hardcover book.
Hmm.
In fact, I don't believe it was ever higher on the New York Times bestseller list as a hardcover than maybe 6 or 7 or 8. That's my memory.
Hmm.
And I believe it never sold more than 40 or 50,000 hardcover copies. What I do know is that it sold so few hardcover copies that by today's standards, it wouldn't even have made the list. What I'm saying is that in order to even get on the list, on the fiction list for hardcover best-selling sales today, you have to sell many more copies so that the actual numbers of readers for fiction, it has increased. The rest of the culture may be going down the tubes and everybody may be staring endlessly at their Blackberries instead of reading a book. But what I'm saying is that literary fiction is, in my estimation, is doing pretty well.
An up note there with Last Night in Twisted River and all the rest. John Irving, it's been a pleasure speaking with you this hour. Thanks for the new book, and thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
John Irving, his new novel, his 12th, Last Night in Twisted River. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.